The 2003 Sunstone Symposium West, held in San Francisco on April 19th, presents session number 34, 101 Reasons to Avoid the Omnis, by David H. Bailey, with a response by Kim McCall.
Okay, so good morning. Welcome to the David H. Bailey session. I think we've all wrestled in one form or another with the kind of problems he's going to address today. I think we've all heard the puzzle. Glenn, would you close the door? I think we've all heard puzzles dealing with this, some very informal kinds of things where if God is all-powerful, how can he make a stone, or can he make a stone that he can't lift? And so it's a very fascinating topic, and I look forward to the discussion. David Bailey.
Thank you. Yes, it is kind of a puzzle. Many Latter-day Saints, including even some general authorities, describe God as omnipotent and omniscient. The terms omnipresent and omnibenevolent are less common, but in LDS circles, but are heard in other Christian denominations. It's interesting that these terms, with the sole exception of the one word omnipotent in a single poetic verse in Revelations, do not appear in the Bible. Instead, they derive from the creeds of traditional Christianity, which were composed during the first few centuries after Christ, when Christianity was recast in terms of Greek metaphysics. If you note that Christianity, as it's taught in the New Testament, is largely devoid of doctrinal speculation of this sort, focusing instead on basic principles of salvation, resurrection, eternal life, which as exemplified in Paul's epistles, and on righteous, humble, and unselfish living as exemplified in Christ's teachings and parables. In most cases that I have seen, people use these terms rather informally, the equivalent of referring to God as the Almighty. But there are knowledgeable Latter-day Saints that are using these terms as formal statements of theological fact. And this has particularly been noticed lately in the church educational system. One scholar, for example, recently declared, quote, God is omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable. And went on to emphasize that this is what the church teaches. I wonder if such people really appreciate what these terms mean, as they are generally understood in the Christian world today. While, again, a comprehensive review of the Christian omni theology, is, we certainly couldn't do that here. I would like to just mention a few items here. This is what I take from the website of a large Protestant organization. And they say, the God of biblical Christianity is at least one, personal and corporal, and incorporeal, something like that, without physical parts. Two, the creator and sustainer of everything else that exists. Three, omnipotent. Four, omniscient. Five, omnipresent. Six, immutable and eternal. And seven, necessary and the only God that exists. And then they go on to give some elaboration of what these doctrines imply. And they say, unlike humans, God is not associated with one physical entity, i.e. a body. Unlike a God who forms the universe out of pre-existent matter, the God of the Bible created the universe ex nihilo, in other words, out of nothing. Consequently, it is on God alone that everything else in the universe, indeed the universe itself, depends for existence. They go on to say, omnipotence literally means all-powerful. This should be understood that God can do anything that is consistent with being a personal, incorporeal, omniscient, omnipresent, immutable, holy good, and necessary creator. God is all-knowing, and his all-knowingness encompasses past, present, and future. He has absolute and total knowledge. And since God is not limited by a spatio-temporal body, it follows that he is in some sense present everywhere. And goes on like this. And he is it follows that God cannot not exist. In other words, he is a necessary being, whereas everything else is contingent or dependent on God for its existence. Some denominations, particularly the evangelical ones, for them a direct corollary of this notion of omniscience and omnipotence is that the Bible is inerrant and complete in every way. And that there can't be any new revelation added on to the Bible. So just from this quick summary, it should be clear that the omnis, as these terms are generally understood in the Christian world today, correspond to theological notions that most Latter-day Saints would find unacceptable. For starters, Joseph Smith and other LDS leaders have taught that God is not incorporeal, but instead has a literal physical existence within time and space. Secondly, we read in D&C section 93, very clearly states that the elements are eternal, and further that the souls of mankind are also eternal and not contingent on God. And Joseph Smith, in separate teachings outside of the D&C, very clearly made this point. And in general, Joseph Smith said that the creeds and these doctrines from which they derive were a mass of confusion. So along this line, several LDS authorities have taught that God works in accord with natural laws and not by standing above or setting aside natural laws. Brigham Young emphasized that there is no such thing as a miracle, only that laws that we might not yet fully understand. Talmage amplifies on this notion. He says, miracles are commonly regarded as occurrences in opposition to the laws of nature. Such a conception is plainly erroneous, for the laws of nature are inviolable. However, as human understanding of these laws is the best and perfect, events strictly in accordance with natural law may appear contrary, but the entire constitution of nature is founded on system and order. 19th century Orson Pratt once started to talk and teach in some of these terms of God being absolutely omniscient, for instance, and could not further increase in knowledge. But Brigham Young, in an official statement of the first presidency, declared that these teachings were false. Wilford Woodruff agreed. He said, if there was a point where man in his progression could not proceed any further, the very idea would throw a gloom over every intelligent and reflecting mind. God himself is still increasing and progressing in knowledge, power, and dominion, and will do so world without end. The 20th century, B.H. Roberts, if any of you have read this book, The Mormon Doctrine of Deity, deals with this at length, and showing how that this distinctive Mormon theology avoids a lot of the pitfalls of traditional Christian theology. David O. McKay noted in one of his books that many years after Joseph Smith's first vision, several large Protestant denominations were finally revising their creeds to remove references to divine predestination, something that Joseph Smith had done a century prior. Again, on the other hand, we have to acknowledge that there have been some instances in LDS literature of these omni doctrines, starting with a passage in the Lectures on Faith. It says that we here observe that God is the only supreme governor and independent being in whom all fullness and perfection dwell, who is omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient without beginning of days or end of life. This is in the Lectures on Faith. Joseph F. Smith once quoted this passage, and Bruce R. McConkie did, mentions it in Mormon Doctrine. And he, in turn, has been quoted by a bunch of others. However, recent historical research has cast doubt as to whether Joseph Smith was really the author of the Lectures on Faith. Quite possibly Sidney Rigdon was really the author instead, in part because of this authorship question and also because of some of these questionable doctrinal notions. The Lectures on Faith were actually dropped from the earliest scriptures about the 1920s. I used to be part of the published scriptures. Anyway, the issue of what theology is taught in the Lectures on Faith is in some sense an academic question, because it's quite clear from other contexts that Joseph Smith distanced himself from these omni doctrines, particularly later in life. So, as is well known, there are many fundamental philosophical and even some scientific difficulties with these omni doctrines. Again, I don't have anywhere near enough time to go into this in detail. Many of you perhaps could even tick off some of these difficulties yourself, but I'd like to quickly list five items here. It says, if God is really absolutely all-powerful, then what are we to make of Satan, or of evil influence in general? Did God create Satan? If so, why? If God is all-powerful, and if he has acted throughout history in the world, why has he permitted human suffering, disease, and death? For example, why did God permit the September 11th terrorists to slam their hijacked airliners into the World Trade Center, killing thousands of good people of all faiths? Consternation over this general issue has led many Christians to lose their faith over the years, as you can imagine. Number three, if God possesses all knowledge and can see arbitrarily far into the future with complete fidelity, then what is the meaning of human free agency? How do we escape the conclusion that we are mere robots acting out a course that was irrevocably set in motion eons ago? How can we be punished for misdeeds? Four, if God is omnipotent in this strong sense, what are we to make of scientific laws, where we see some of these principles obeyed with extreme precision and complete consistency? Again, this has been another major issue that has dogged Christianity ever since the time of Galileo. And then one fifth item here, Christian writers have further asserted that these omni-doctrines imply that God's nature is completely uniform and undifferentiated, without body parts and passions. One problem with this claim is that from certain fundamental principles of thermodynamics and computer science, it follows that not only could not God not be omniscient, but in fact God cannot be the repository of any information at all. I further examined this idea in an article with myself and Hollis Johnson, who's an astronomer at the University of Indiana. With regard to item number three, with this issue of God having knowledge to completely see the future in full detail, I, for one, am not persuaded by the traditional arguments that free agency is compatible with God's foreknowledge. It seems to me that if the future can be seen or predicted with complete fidelity by any means, by anyone, even by a future super powerful computer, then it follows that only one future course of the universe is logically possible. In that event, it's hard to see how we can avoid a complete conclusion of determinism. In other words, it's hard to see that if the complete course of our lives, thoughts and actions, was already sort of set in concrete eons ago, how can we be held responsible for any actions, good or bad, in any meaningful sense? Or worse still, we are led to the distasteful conclusion that God is responsible for our predicament because he set the system into motion. This notion that the future can be predicted perfectly based on projections from the current state goes back at least to the physicist Laplace in the 1700s. He wrote the following. an intelligence knowing all the forces acting in nature at a given instant, as well as the momentary positions of all things in the universe, would be able to comprehend in one single formula the motions of the largest bodies as well as the lightest atoms, provided that its intellect were sufficiently powerful to subject all data to analysis. To it, nothing would be uncertain. The future as well as the past would be present to its eyes. Unfortunately, the notion of Laplace's notion of a clockwork universe was destroyed by 20th century science. First, quantum mechanics showed that the very data that we need to make these predictions, namely the unlimited precision measurement of the current state of the of a physical system, is fundamentally unattainable. This is not a limitation of current measurement technology, but as far as we know, is a fundamental limitation of this universe that we inhabit. Some have questioned whether these quantum mechanical laws, which apply principally to atomic scale systems, have any impact in the full-scale world that we live in worth taking seriously. But consider, for example, the moment when genetic molecules from two human beings unite to form a new individual, or when a cell divides. It's well known that even a slight disturbance to these delicate processes, such as from a chance encounter with a cosmic ray, can have drastic long-term consequences. What's more, recent research in the field of chaos suggests that this type of magnification of microscopic effects is more the rule than the exception. In other words, many physical systems have the property that microscopic changes or uncertainties can lead to arbitrarily large deviations in the future. And this fact, together with this issue of quantum mechanics that we mentioned, pretty well rules out this clockwork universe and draws into question any notion that any being that who is within the scope of the universe can have this absolute foreknowledge. Again, this doesn't mean that all predictions of physical phenomena are impossible. We do this all the time on our supercomputers at the Berkeley lab. But there is a limit to this predictability. Like we can do simulations of the Earth's climate even like a century or two into the future, and we can get some fairly reliable statistics now on the overall climate statistics, say 100 years to the future. But we cannot possibly ever hope to accurately predict the local weather at some specific point in time or location far into the future. That's these laws of chaos fundamentally forbid that type of absolute prediction. Is there a question?
I think what you're saying there focuses on the assumption that everything is viewed from a fixed point in time. If there is a elasticity in time, there's nothing that says the observer can have moved down the timeline to observe the outcome from the future,
I think scientists would disagree with that for exactly this point of view, is that all of these issues of causality rule out that type of foreknowledge and communicating it back. In other words, it comes down to this essential issue: does the future exist, and is it already set in concrete? Could we move forward in the future and see the future?
No,
and the answer appears to be no.
Be able to move out on the line and come back.
But the point is, from fundamental physical principles, it appears that that's not possible. And so that's where I'm getting here, is that the whole notion that there is one single course of the future is fundamentally wrong from a scientific point of view. Anyway. Looking at these issues from an LDS point of view, there isn't nearly enough time to review all of the LDS discourse on this comment, on this question, but I'll just mention just a few. If any of you have seen Sterling McMurrin's book, The Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion, which is really just a classic that he really grasped what was really unique about the Mormon theology and how it avoids a lot of these problems that have afflicted other denominations. You know, just one quote I'll read. Mormon theologians have moved somewhat ambiguously between the emotionally satisfying absolutism of traditional theism and the radical finitism logically demanded by their denial of creation and encouraged by the pragmatic character of their daily faith. Here they have often failed to recognize the strength of their own position and have, therefore, neglected to grasp and appreciate the full meaning of its implications. There have been several more recent studies. There was an article by Kent Robson a few years back. More recently, Blake Ostler, Dennis Porter have written articles and dialogue. Gene England had a very interesting issue just in the previous, not the current, but the previous issue of Dialogue, I believe. It's called The Weeping God of Mormonism. And again, emphasizing this nature of our faith that steers us away from these omni-doctrines to a more realistic faith. In the current issue of Dialogue, there was a fellow, Brian Ferguson, wrote a letter to the editor saying we should make copies of that article and send it to all of our friends because to counter this trend that we're seeing where these omni-doctrines are being popular again. Even aside from some of these scholarly treatments, I think most rank and file LDS people would respond to this question number one that I listed, the existence of evil, by arguing that Satan lived in the pre-mortal world and, like us, had an eternal existence independent of God. In other words, God didn't specifically create Satan. Satan already existed. This is actually a rather effective response. But note that this argument rejects the traditional Christian omni-doctrine that God is the only uncreated and non-contingent being. Again, here's an example where the LDS doctrine very clearly is distinct from the traditional notion of these omni-doctrines that are taught in other denominations. LDS people typically respond to the question of human suffering either by blaming these calamities on the influence of Satan, which defers us to question number one, or by appealing to the indispensable nature of human free agency, which defers to question number three, or by appealing to the operation of natural law, which defers to question number four. Which is fine, we'll discuss that. But note that for people that appeal to free agency as to explain the existence of human suffering, that begs the question as to why human free agency is so indispensable. And again, many LDS people would argue that this is a fundamental principle to which even God is subject, or at least chooses to obey. But then note that this rejects the traditional Christian omni-doctrine that God's omnipotence places him absolutely and utterly above any other law or principle. By saying that there are principles to which God is subject, or even that he chooses to obey, notice we are rejecting this notion that God is utterly above and beyond any other principle.
One thing about omnipotence doctrine, it says that it's a self-contradiction because it says God is incapable of recreating something like himself. He cannot recreate himself. So
yeah.
He is limited in that way right away. So there's some contradiction in the concept of omnipotence.
For instance. But again, even setting aside these logical contradictions. See, like even St. Augustine, 1,000 years ago, would have responded to you, say, well, we'll say God's omnipotence only goes to the extent to which it is not a logical contradiction. You know, and so in some sense, those can be deflected that way. What I'm arguing here is even some of these more fundamental issues are theologically, or at least that Mormonism traditionally rejects these questions. Let me just go on here just a little bit further before we we get too much into discussion here. We mentioned about free agency, and again, I think many people, many LDS people try to say, well, God's foreknowledge doesn't rule out our free agency. Well, I think it does. I'm not persuaded by these arguments that it doesn't. But again, I think from a scientific perspective, it gives us a possible solution. Namely, we have to back off a little bit from absolute future prediction that there must be some details, some specifics that God can't see with perfect fidelity, even if the overall course of human affairs can be anticipated. Otherwise, again, if we really say, if God really knew what socks I would put on this morning, then it's just really hard to see how human free agency has any real meaning. With regard to this question on scientific law and what we make of scientific law if God's action is everywhere. Again, the LDS response has been a bit mixed. On one side, there's a strong tradition of scientific excellence in the church. At least at one point, the number of practicing research scientists that had LDS background was just off the scale, and even now is very strong. On the minus side, at the local level, the wards and stakes, most people seem to have a very traditional worldview in that they typically reject most of science as just being mere theories. And so it's not unusual here in the 21st century to hear LDS people say that the earth was created in 7 days or 7,000 years, and that it's also common to hear that accounts of answers to prayers in which, say, to paraphrase Ambrose Bierce, that God has annulled the laws of the universe on behalf of a single petitioner who by his own confession is unworthy. Anyway, the solution again is clear. That if once we acknowledge, as Brigham Young and Talmage and others have very clearly taught in historical LDS literature, that God works within the realm of natural laws and not by completely superseding them, completely stepping outside over and above natural law, then this issue loses most of its punch. I think so in that regard, Brigham Young, Talmage, and others who have pointed out that there are no such things as miracles, and that behind every act of God is some rational, natural explanation. They were clearly ahead of his time. Even recently, Russell M. Ballard, just a couple years ago, for instance, wrote in a book of his, he said, if there is a God, someone said, how could he allow such things to happen? The answer isn't easy, but it isn't that complicated either. God has put his plan into motion. It proceeds through natural laws, which in fact are God's laws. And because they are his, he is bound by them as we are. Again, notice in each of these cases, the LDS solution to these issues is basically amounts to a denial of the fundamental premise on which these issues were constructed. Namely, that as Christians, we are historically bound to accept these omni-doctrines in the traditional sense. We as Mormons aren't bound by these creeds. They were all swept away right from the first vision onward. So we don't have to worry about the consequences of these doctrines because they aren't part of our beliefs, not in any fundamental sense. Again, no one knows, and I certainly don't pretend to know how to resolve all of these questions, but the point is this should not be a critical burning issue for Latter-day Saints as they are for most other faiths. So in summary, again, this traditional notion of an absolutely omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent deity is not only problematic from a number of philosophical and scientific points of view, but as far as I can see, goes against a number of fundamental LDS beliefs. In this light, it is truly unfortunate that we hear these omni-doctrines being taught again in the church today. Why follow other denominations down a theological path that has proven so problematic and destructive of faith? Certainly it is reasonable to believe that God is very powerful and His knowledge is very great. We can even see ourselves and the good works that we do as part of God's increasing glory. But it is essential that we avoid absolute, dogmatic, or inflexible theological positions in this arena. Extreme positions are almost never valid, and this is certainly true in the theological arena as it is in daily life. So again, one could say, well, we should counter this current discourse that's favorable to the omnis by counter it with a more liberal flavor of theology, say teaching and promoting this notion of a finite progressing God, which was taught by a lot of several early LDS leaders, and which is often favored by LDS liberals such as myself. But I wonder if there's even a more fundamental lesson to be learned here, namely that there is danger in any sort of theological speculation. Certainly most of us would agree that the unbridled theological speculation of the past has led to numerous unfortunate consequences. We only need to list the notion that practicing polygamy is essential to be exalted in the celestial kingdom, which was taught at least several instances in the 19th century. The notion that certain sins requires one's blood to be shed in retribution, certainly this had some very unfortunate consequences. The notion that blacks were less valiant in the Council of Heaven, we hope we finally put that nonsense behind us, although it still rears its ugly head. And the notion that the 7 days of creation, as given in the scriptures, were literally 24-hour or 1,000-year periods, which is, you know, now scientifically completely untenable. And even like the notion that the Book of Mormon is literally the history of the entire Western Hemisphere ancient people. Again, we recognize this is really not a defensible concept at this point in time. So, but the point is, clearly these speculations were unwarranted even from a purely scriptural point of view, not to mention the scientific and historical and secular and ethical even problems involved. A clear lesson of these experiences is not to engage in additional speculation now, which 50 or 100 years from now people are going to groan and say, oh, that Bailey guy back then, why did he teach that nonsense? Look what a quagmire it's got us into, or anyone else in the church. Maybe it's just time to set aside all that kind of stuff and focus on the more basics of what our religion should be about, namely the practical benefits of good, clean living. It says, besides, there's also a practical benefit of this from even just an everyday point of view in the church. When someone in a church setting presents some questionable doctrinal notion, no matter what the source is, engaging in a debate with that person is often more divisive, leads to ill will than it is convincing. In contrast, it's usually much easier and certainly less likely to give offense to simply point out that such a notion represents a speculative extrapolation from well-established scriptural principles and probably should be avoided. But again, it's important to keep in mind this sort cuts both ways. LDS liberals are often annoyed when they hear someone speculating at length, for instance, about what happened in the Council of Heaven or what is contained in the sealed portion of the Book of Mormon. But do we expect LDS conservatives to react any differently when they hear detailed speculation, for example, on the attributes of Mother in Heaven? Speculation is speculation, and dogmatism is dogmatism, whether it be conservative or liberal in origin. Mormonism has always tried, not always successfully, to be, again, a practical, reasonable religion, right from the beginning. People are more important than doctrines. Certain doctrinal precepts have even been changed or set aside over the years in keeping with the Ninth Article of Faith. So in this regard, perhaps the Church is basically on the right track in its current program, at least under the presidency of President Hinckley, of trying to maintain a relatively simple doctrinal foundation, avoiding theological quagmires, and focusing instead on basic gospel principles and good, clean, charitable Christian living. And note that this is one area where all the Church can unite. Liberals and conservatives, young and old, newly baptized and lifelong members, foreign converts and five-generation pioneer descendants. And it's also an area where thinking Latter-day Saints can participate with full intellectual honesty. Thank you.
We have a response. In the call,
please.
What time are we supposed to stop here?
10 till.
Oh, great.
Yes, we'll
have to. I won't go on forever. I just want to make sure there's a little time here. So I've been asked to respond to a paper with which I almost completely agree. Usually when you have a commentator, you're supposed to present a conflicting point of view, and I do disagree with a few things toward the very end of the paper and want to emphasize a few things about the paper. Mostly, though, I think David realizes that I'm one of those liberal theologians, or to the extent that I'm a theologian at all, I'm one of the liberals who rejects the omnis and finds joy in continuing to think about those sorts of things. I think there's nothing clearer in the LDS fundamental deep theology than the rejection of the creation of the universe ex nihilo. Okay, the Doctrine and Covenants, section 93, is completely clear, as David pointed out, that the elements are eternal and that spirits are eternal. The question is, does this imply a rejection of omnipotence? He quotes, let's see, did I write this down? Sterling McMurrin saying that a radical finitism is demanded by the denial of creation. Okay. Is it a logical requirement? Let me say at least one little thing. If it isn't the case that, let's see, if you say that God is all-powerful, then it doesn't matter whether he created the universe out of nothing or not. He may as well have. Okay. If the pre-existing elements in the universe don't imply any kind of limitations on his power, then he might as well have created everything out of nothing, because he can still transform it into whatever he wants. And so the Joseph Smith's explicit and the Doctrine of Covenants' explicit rejection of creation out of nothing is a pointless doctrine, unless it's followed by the idea that those things out of which he created the universe had laws of their own. And when Elder Ballard says the natural laws are God's laws, he has to be real careful what he means. Okay, one could say they're laws that God put into being as part of nature. Okay, but that's not the same as saying those elements existed as independent of him and he dealt with them according to their own principles. Okay, the natural laws are God's laws in the sense that he has to obey them the same way. I mean, has to obey. He's controlled by them, or limited by them, the same sense that we are. That's the strong notion of what it means to say that there's no creation out of nothing. Okay, that the elements that pre-existed have their own principles, and to say that God obeys natural laws is to say that he understands those principles and works within them. The website that David quoted had I'm a Sunday school teacher and a seminary teacher, and now, believe it or not, an institute teacher. And this website said that, I've got it underlined here, the God of the Bible created the universe ex nihilo, goes on to talk about his omnipotence and his omniscience and everything like that. And I just want to preach for just a minute about the God of the Bible. I'm going to have a Bible, which I brought with me for this purpose. And who are the three biggest figures in the Bible? Leave Adam out for just a second. The three biggest figures in the Bible, the three greatest teachers, the three most important folks. Moses,
Abraham,
Jesus. Thank you very much. We're going to start with the first one, with Abraham. Okay. What was Abraham's conception of God? Okay. Abraham got into an argument with God about whether he was supposed to destroy the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. For one thing, Abraham believed that it was possible to change God's mind. Okay. That God had a plan. Presumably that meant that he intended to do something and thought it was going to happen. Abraham believed that he could change God's mind. And most important, Abraham said to him, suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not forgive it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? Okay. Abraham believed with Joseph Smith that there was a moral law that was above God. He believed with Joseph Smith, in principle, it's possible for God to do something contrary to the law of righteousness. Okay. God doesn't make the law. Okay, he's judged by them the same way as the rest of us. Okay, if you read outside the Doctrine and Covenants, I'm going to tell you how God came to be God. Okay, I mean, it's just crazy. God came to be God. That means he changes over time. That means he develops. That means he learns. That means a lot of things about where he stands in relationship to time. Okay, there's just a tremendous amount of implications about that. But what I want to emphasize here is that, you know, to Abraham, God is subject to the same laws as the rest of us. He stands in relation to the universe, both morally and physically, in the same relationship as the rest of us. Moses, very similarly, number two person in the Bible. Whatever you want to say. Understood that you could change God's mind. Okay. You may recall that when God noticed the fact that Israel was creating a golden calf, he was, I believe, wroth, is the King James Version, but anyway, he was upset about this fact, and he decided that he was going to do away with this chosen people. He was going to get another chosen people, because these people weren't doing it. And says to Moses, I've seen this people, how stiff-necked they are. Now let me alone so that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them. And of you I will make a great nation. Okay, he's had it with Abraham's children. He's going to start over with Moses' children. But Moses implored the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn so hot? Blah, 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 blah. Verse 14. And the Lord changed his mind about the disaster that he planned to bring on his people. Okay. So much for God being immutable. But, you know, presumably he had a plan that he changed. Okay, he told Jonah, tell Nineveh that I'm going to destroy them. He explicitly did not say, and this is left out of the book of Jonah on purpose. He didn't say, I'm going to destroy the city unless the people repent. He said, I'm going to destroy the city. And the king of Nineveh said, you know, maybe if we put on sackcloth and ashes, he won't destroy us. And he didn't. Okay. So the foreknowledge of God is the thrust of those stories is that, you know, God thinks he's going to do something and he changes his mind. And if he thinks he's going to do something, his foreknowledge is, and he doesn't do it, there's something wrong with his foreknowledge. But, you know, the point I'm trying to make is that that's the theological point. The point is that Moses didn't understand, the God of the Bible changed his mind, okay? And Moses' understanding of God was that he was somebody who could compare to a judge who didn't want to give somebody justice, and the woman kept coming into him and kept coming to him and said, finally, just to get her out of my hair, I'm going to give her justice, okay? That God could be persuaded through prayer, okay? That God, and Jesus, you know, doesn't have a concept of a God who's, you know, this is just one example, but, you know, his concept of God is one who can change his mind, who can change his plans, who can be effective, okay? So the God of the Bible is nothing like the God of the philosophers. Okay.
He's not like the God of that website.
He's not like the God of that website. Okay. He's really not. I mean, to claim, I mean, it's one thing to claim that Mormons are wrong. It's another claim that they don't believe in the God of the Bible. Okay. And the God of the Bible really isn't like the God of the website or the God of the Omnis. Okay. Really isn't. And that really, as David says, was introduced in the attempt of Christians to integrate themselves into the world of Hellenistic thought with all of its absolutes. And that's where those doctrines come from. And we shouldn't be apologetic about believing in a God who can change his mind or a God who is changing over time. And I want to get through a couple more things that I want to say here. Does any of this matter? Okay. I mean, suppose we have a finitistic theology. Let me propose, I ran this by my institute kids, and they were confronting it for the first time, but does our rejection of omnipotence, or our embrace of it, have any consequences to our actions and to our aggression? Okay, David's interested in how we behave, okay, in living good lives and teaching our people to live good, clean, Christian lives, okay? I want to at least propose the idea that our theology has made a difference to our lives, okay? That the scientific excellence of the Mormon community is motivated by our belief that science is about something real, okay? Our belief that God's world and the world of the scientists is the same world, okay? And that believing in that, we are motivated to take the world seriously, okay, and to include, you know, among the pursuits worthy of our best minds, the challenge of mastering that world. It seems to fit with our extremely positive view of human nature and human potential. Okay. It gives fuel to the LDS/Enlightenment sense of human empowerment, which has led to our scientific and technical progress. Also leads, you know, there are dangers in it, okay? It reduces a certain kind of awe and humility. The awe and humility that might lead us to protect the Earth, okay? To put limits on our exploitation. You know, the technological revolution is not without its cost, okay? It weakens our sense of awe, oh, and possibly of our sense of submission, okay? That if you believe in this really other, really powerful, really mystical God, there's a sense of human weakness and the need of submission to that God. Islam is based as its primary moral imperative is submission to God. That's what the concept of Islam is. Okay, Mormonism is not so open to that. Okay, that God, if God is one of us in some eternal sense, even though we're not anywhere near there yet, then the sense of submission is much, much weaker. Okay, my hope is that this guards against crusades. Okay, that the idea that God could ask us to do something that's crazy or that's immoral is harder for Mormons to swallow than for other people. Okay, because he's not that different from us, okay? And he only asks us to do things that make some kind of sense, okay, in our same kind of world. And I would like to believe that extreme forms of fundamentalism would be naturally more foreign to Mormons because of our theology. You know, we have our fundamentalists, but they're fundamentalists about picky little things. They're not hopefully, flying airplanes into buildings. Finally, I want to talk about faithfulness. David points out that a theology, he says Mormon theology is less susceptible to the pitfalls of traditional theology. Such a theology should prove more resilient, okay, as more is discovered through research or through reason. A theology that is more limited is going to be less prone to producing atheists. Okay, what I want to say is faithless tradition flees its power, and unbelief gives way. The darkened clouds that used to lower submit to reason's sway. Verse 3 of Sweet is the Peace the Gospel Brings. That as we have a more reasonable theology, we get rid of certain kinds of tradition. Okay. And so my defense, I want to give a defense of theological speculation. Okay. Even though I agree with the criticism of the Omni, I want to say that the business of continuing to do theology is a good one. And I recognize the dangers, and I recognize that historically, the chances of being right and the chances of being wrong don't look good, okay? Thomas Aquinas is smarter than me, and he made a lot of mistakes. And nevertheless, working under some degree of inspiration and some degree of revelation from Joseph Smith, I think that I pointed out some advantages of good theology, and that we ought to, that good theology ought to lead to good ethical doctrines and practices. That to the extent that we have a valid theology, it's going to motivate better practice, and that's sort of abstractly speaking, but I hope I gave a good example. Also, the sense of theological grounding leads to greater commitment and greater conviction and a greater sense of urgency. Okay, that if you become the Quakers and the Unitarian, and you get rid of your theology and you just practice good beliefs, okay, I like those people and I like what they do in the world, but the conviction and the commitment that Mormonism gets out of its people, the immense amount of energy that we put into either converting the world or doing good in the world, comes, I think, out of the fact that we believe that there's something really there, okay, that's the ground for this and that's motivating us, and God wants us to do these things. And I think that becoming a purely practical religion will eventually lose that sense of motivation, that sense of grounding. And finally, for some of us, our spirits may demand the constant search for more light. And whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, we will be unfulfilled, and we will not fulfill the measure of our creation if we simply satisfy ourselves with simple sorts of beliefs and simple and the denial of the deeper spiritual life and the deeper intellectual life. Thanks.
Toby.
I'm very comfortable with things as an offender, but does Talmage, who's kind of one of the archetypes of the scientific criticism, doesn't his book start as a faith talk about seeing God as omnipotent?
Yeah, he does.
And I don't think he
quite saw it, and yet at another point.
Come to the mic. Yeah.
Okay. Repeat the question. Yeah, okay. The question is that I mentioned Talmage. Well, didn't Talmage in Articles of Faith teach the Omnis? And yes, he did. I just found this out just a few days ago in doing the research for this. And yet in this other part of the Articles of Faith, he mentioned some of these other principles, like the fact that God works within the bounds of natural laws and other things that go against that. So, this is part of the schizophrenia that I think that Mormons have had with regard to these Omni doctrines. On one hand, in very fundamental ways, we deny them, particularly in the sweeping sense that they are taught in traditional Christianity, and yet in other places we use these terms and talk about them. And I think it's mostly just a matter of not really recognizing the full sweep of what these terms mean outside of Mormonism. and therefore it's some caution is in order.
Yeah, let me comment just very quickly on that same question. There are people who use this. Jean England tried to make a distinction between two modes of discourse. One is the worshipful mode of discourse, in which we are in awe and praising God and pondering His greatness, and we tend to use these sorts of words. And the other mode of discourse is speculative, intellectual, in which, and I don't want to say just intellectual, I love the quote from Wilford Woodruff, where he says, he pairs two things. He says, and this was in the paper, it casts a great pall over us if I imagine that my progress will ever stop. And I can't worship a God, and I don't believe in a God, who's not growing. Okay, in the mode in which we think of God as an exemplar of our future, okay, then we're doing the speculative, and we're thinking much more finitistically, and we'll use those words. And it's each mode of discourse has its place, according to Brother England. And when we read the Omnes, there's a certain amount of that going on. My own opinion is that lately, and perhaps with Elder Talmadge, but especially with the one quote that David had earlier in the paper, that there's so much PR going on right now that we're trying to feel comfortable to conservative Christians in America. And so we use these words that feel comfortable to them. The danger is that we're going to get sucked into believing it. Okay.
There's someone, I think that's Tolstoy, that made an observation. Leo Tolstoy made an observation that after looking at the combatants in the wars, is that after a while, both sides of the of both parties fighting tend to start looking just exactly like each other. And I wonder if this is happening in Mormonism, where we're so stunned by all these criticisms that we've had from the evangelicals that Mormons aren't Christians, and so the response over time is to become more and more like them, and that's most certainly not the right thing to do.
As we have become more American than now.
Yes.
We were once un-American. Clint.
All right. First of all, I'll put out something quickly, then I have a question for David. In terms of the whole predestination question, right, yeah, Talmadge comes down in favor of God knowing everything ahead of time. And one of his chief opponents, actually, has been Bruce R. McConkie, not directly going out and saying James E. Talmadge was full of such and such, but rather that God doesn't know everything that you're going to do because you have free agency. So I always was quite cheered and encouraged. Yeah, I was quite cheered and encouraged that McConkie was on my side. What? Well, he quite possibly was contradictory, but I'm resting his sayings for my own purpose, and I'm only remembering the parts with which I agree. Those of you who know me, this will not be surprised by this. All right, but my question to David is, you've been a scientist for, 20, 30 years, plus. How has this changed your view of God? How has your view of God changed, say, from when you first got out of graduate school to now?
Well, the question, again, was how has my scientific career changed my view of God? And I think, again, I keep coming back, like the creationists, for instance, that still teach in this 21st century that the Earth was really just created in a few thousand years ago. Some will allow a 7,000-year period instead of just 7 days, but or that it was just, in some of them, quite literally, that the Earth and the entire universe were created in one wave of a magic wand about 6,000 years B.C., about 4,000 B.C., I guess. And of course, no evolution, much of modern science is simply set aside. And one of them actually said in one of these creationist books, that with regards to the notion of we see light coming in from distant stars that from all that are millions of light years away, and from all indications, well, how could this be? And so this fellow actually said, well, God wanted to set into motion a completely functioning universe, and so this included photons already streaming in as if they were coming from distant stars, but of course it was all done a few thousand years ago. And so this leads to the notion, in my view, of God the great deceiver. You know, and if there is anything that Mormons should be against, and that thinking people of any stripe should be against, is the notion of God the great deceiver. You know, if there are these laws that are in operation, that should tell us something about God. That should not be taken as deception from God. And that, I think, is the single central notion that I get from being a scientist, is that to say that these laws and operation that we observe, that has to be telling us something about reality. God is not a deceiver.
Okay, then if you allow for a God limited by our understanding of natural law.
Not necessarily. No. No one is suggesting that our current, that God is limited by our current natural laws.
My real question is, how far away is God, if he can spring by any form of natural law and be able to answer our prayers in real time? How far away is he within Einstein's limitation of speed of light? If you want to use Einstein, let's use his limitation of speed of light.
Again, these are all very interesting questions. I don't pretend to know the answer of how all that works. Maybe a lot of that works differently than we've traditionally thought. I'm willing to be very open-minded. I'm even be willing to say that that you know, maybe God is simply drawing us towards good. And maybe that's what God is all about. But beyond that, I'm willing to accept what comes. Yes.
I'm concerned that what you said today in the high technology of the church and the science, but I don't see it in our manuals. Our literature comes out slowly.
And what's worse is that I happen to know that the person who is in charge of correlation, which oversees, among other things, the church manuals, is a person of a very conservative-minded, who is very fond of this Mormon neo-orthodox theology that's being taught at BYU. So that's why our manuals tend to be of that flavor.
And how to put gentle pressure.
Write letters. When you see something in one of these manuals that's just off base or problematic, or you just don't feel is right or is misleading, send a letter to Salt Lake saying, you know, I am concerned about this manual. At least someone will read it. Last year there was in the Ensign, it was about a year and a half ago that at the beginning of Joseph F. Smith, when that manual series started. So this must have been a couple of 3 years ago. They published in the Ensign this 1909 statement by the first presidency that including these on the origin of man, that appears to rule out the possibility of evolution. And this was prefaced by a little note that says, you know, here at the beginning of the year when we're discussing the creation, we want to set out what the official LDS view of evolution is. And then they included this article. Of course, anyone that studied the history knows that that's completely out of context. That statement was revised and those anti-evolution paragraphs removed in 1925. Then more recently, under Hinckley, if you write a note to Hinckley, to the first presidency now, and you say, what is the official church view on evolution, you'll just get a very short statement that says, leave biology, archaeology, and geology, no one of which has to do with the gospel of Christ, to the field of scientific research, while we focus on the kingdom, as I recall, as the... That's what you'll get. And that's the real official view of the church. And so what was printed in the ensign really was both out of context and not really reflective of the church's official view. So again, we can disdain this, we can grumble and moan, you know, this is one more instance of whether these conservative doctrines are being promoted, or you can write a letter. I wrote a letter, and it actually got read.
Actually, in fact, the science department, the religion department,
oh, they're at war. They're at war, and this is a continual frustration for the scientists at BYU. They've been fighting this battle over and over. They supposedly had a truce a while back, because there was a packet of the church's material, like on evolution and theology, that was made available, that was going to be what everyone would agree, which is certain First Presidency statements that I just mentioned. And as far as they can tell now, that's just basically ignored. So again, this is a little bit off the topic of here, but in general, when you hear theological speculation or you hear stuff that's being taught in manuals or even, you know, anecdotally, write letters, complain. If no one's complaining, then that will be, in fact, the doctrine of the church. We're sort of over time. So I think we have a couple. Oh, we do. Oh, great. Go ahead.
As far as there being a truce, it seems like the truce is only honored by one half. I keep seeing in church people getting up and blasting the idea of evolution, and it happens all the time in seminary classes. Kids will come home and say, well, guess what the seminary teacher said? Well, that's not church doctrine. If I were to get up in sacrament meeting and give a lesson on evolution, I would rightly be slapped down by the bishop. You can't do that. That's not the church policy. But if someone gets up and does the opposite, it seems they just ignore it. I may have misunderstood what Dave said earlier about getting away from theological quagmires, and wondered, what's the necessity of being LDS? What makes us unique if we don't have some quagmires out there? We may all end up becoming Unitarian, which may be okay, but I think that's a question that church leaders have, you know, if we dumb it down too much. And yet I see that they want to have it both ways. The last few years we seem to be getting away from theological distinctiveness. Larry King was the classic example of it. And what does the Mormons believe about men becoming gods? And President Hinckley's answer on nationwide TV, well, I don't know that we actually know very much about that. And there's a cute little couplet and one thing, but we don't really know what happens. And a lot of us old-time Mormons are going to go, wait a minute, that's what I was bred on. I was brought up on that doctrine of Joseph Smith. What are Mormons all about, if not about that? And then in trying to have it both ways, at conference later, he said, well, those of you that heard that, I know what's right. You don't need to worry that I've... So in other words, yeah, he didn't say what he knew because he didn't want to be held to it. I think he wants to have it both ways. You know, we're respectable, but we still have something that's so unique that you need to be Mormon and nothing else. We also in the church have a history of theological debate. It's been brought up between Talmage and McConkie and a bunch of others. Is that something we want to get away from, even though it may be divisive? If we don't have theological debate or dispute, who's going to have the last word? And I would hate for it to be someone like McConkie.
Haven't we already gotten away from debate? It seems to me that the reason I'm about correlation seems to be that here's the last word, thank you very much. I hope I'm wrong, but that's what I'm inferring from the new year right now. What do you think?
It's hard to say. Again, I think in general we are seeing a palpable shift away from some of the theological wanderings of years past, but on the other hand, the current manuals, materials are just dreadfully dull. Certainly, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be, but I do think, though, with regard to theology, I think this is perhaps a defining time for Mormonism. We need to sit down and say, what is it that we really believe, you know? Prune away a lot of the more peripheral stuff when it really comes down to the
what is it that we most treasure, guard and protect that, and let the other blow away. But what is that core that we need to defend? What is that core that really defines us as Mormons? I think that's something that we need to define, and that's perhaps something that we'll be so challenged with during the next few years.
I have some copies of this, and it's also available on my website, which is www.chbailey.com.
Enjoy it.
How you doing? Oh, sure, yeah.